Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I am Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Douglas Manuel.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask about their latest book.
What was difficult and what was easy about writing it.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
If you want to hear more about the writers we interviewed and work with them in person, you can attend a live reading and workshop with them at the Poetry Salon.
Find out more and register for great workshops and events with us and our favorite poets at www.thepoetrysalon.com.
Now, without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
Bowl, after reading Fugue for Other Hands by Joseph Bazzano. In your next life, you will be birthed in needles of hoarfrost. Your eyes still in the blue gauze between this world and the next. And I will kneel so close, you will smell the hot iron waiting to singe your skin. You'll hear the crackle of the flame, and your throat will prickle with stars. I'll wrap your shins in nettle, and this shelter will fall deeply into zero. This is the start of your suffering for the children, yours, who became the wanderers, beaten between the withers, broken and unridable in the world's dark loam. There is no animal to save you now, no purling stream to fold shame into, not even the jackdaw as witness, or a single crofter awake in this cat's eye hour. Revenge tries on its black bridle, then drapes it over the swinging fence. Father, I will not take out your eyes, but I will brand you with the word you fear, and you will wear it, and you will wear it, and give up everything to winter. Reflections on La Scabigliata, The Girl with Disheveled Hair by Leonardo da Vinci. 1. This face, a house of stars before the fall, Lorca's round silence of night. One note on the stave of the infinite. As if the head were a hermeneutic circle that we may know the whole through our parts, the distance from chin to nose, and roots to eyebrows, in each the same. You can feel Leonardo's brush above the soft triangle of cheek, the light left below the eyes, rooms he admires, but never enters. Who knows what they have witnessed? Pupils of a black moon carry the codices of more than one life. Her thoughts cast toward a world of inner frescoes. Here is the spirit's underpainting, awash in the clear glaze before a commitment to color. And don't think she is unaware of her inner nudity, not as one would be conscious of a body, but the way a bolt of silk rests on the edge of a dune. 2. She can't stop looking in your direction, a horizon that never makes its way toward her. Her face as a field, hash marks of hay, hair drawn from wild grasses. When daylight fell into the small room of her, the body seemed remote. There is a falling of hands, the light through the window, making shapes until you leave. 3. If she stepped out of her face just once, the landscape would be white foxes at twilight, her hand a frozen river, her mouth a creature half locked in ice. When she looks at you without eyes, you see your history like the back of your head. Winter is the god she returns to. 4. Disheveled, undone, disarrayed, let down, the howl of human utterances, the hair a part de ça. Just as she is, just as I was, fresh from the ochre linens, feet padding on worn wood, leaving sunlight striped across the pillow. Once I dreamed, I awoke in her body. It was me looking out of the petite form. Just the suggestion of a swell below the neckline, like two koi coming up for air. I place my palms on each gesture. This is what the mirror saw.
All right. You have been listening to the voice of Lois P. Jones. Lois P. Jones, welcome to the podcast. I'm going to read your bio here. Lois P. Jones's work was highly commended and published in the 2021 Gridport Poetry Prize Anthology. Other honors include the 2022 Lyra Fest Frame to Frames, Ekphrastic Poetry Film Prize for her film poem collaboration, La Scapigliata, the 2017 Bristol Poetry Prize, the Lasso Poetry Prize, the Tifrit Poetry Prize, and winning finalist for the 2018 Terrain Poetry Contest, judged by Jane Hirschfield. Jones has work published or forthcoming in Academy of American Poets, A Poem a Day, Poetry Wales, Plume, Guernica Editions, Valentine Mitchell of London, First Daily, and Narrative. Jones' first collection, Night Ladder, was published by Glass Lyre Press in 2017 and was a finalist for the Julie Suck Award. Jones is the poetry editor of Kyoto Journal and a screening judge for Claremont University's Kingsley Tufts Award. Such a pleasure to have you. It's so funny. I was tripping over some of those words, and I was telling someone today about your book and saying, she's made me go to the dictionary 3 times to look up certain words I didn't know, which is, you know, such a pleasure when I get to read something and learn about the world or learn about something I didn't know through poetry. So thank you so much, Lois, for being here. I believe you and Doug already know each other. You want to say a little bit about that?
Sure. So for many years, I hosted Poe's Cafe on KPFK, and I had the great opportunity to interview Doug. We had such an intense, great conversation. Doug can, you know, dispute that or validate that, whatever he wants.
Oh, no, I will validate that all day and tomorrow. It's not very often that people are kind with your work and also can see you through your work. And I think, honestly, Lois and I became friends after that interview, like instantly. And we talked at that moment that we felt, you know, kind of a almost mystical cosmic poetry connection as far as reaching for the numinous. And I think that's one of the things that I really, really adore about your work is the high lyric intensity and the always reaching for almost ocular, like these get to a whole level of real kind of meaning making when it comes to that. So I can't wait to jump in to talk about that. But since then, Lois and I have been judges, screeners for the Tufts together for a really long time. And then we also just kind of see each other, like LA poetry, say what? Like I'll be somewhere and then there go Lois. I'd be like, hi Lois, how are you? Lois always makes me feel less alone.
oh, that's beautiful. I feel the same way. Well, you know, I love your work. Much.
No, and same. I mean, revisiting your work this time, like I said, I was kind of, I had forgotten how much your work can be of the body and outside of materiality at the same time. And I think you kind of achieve that through the juxtaposition of like abstraction and concreteness. You know, some of these lines just really kill me, like see history like the back of a head. Like, again, always whenever you go abstract, you marry it with the body. So I don't know if I'm jumping the gun by jumping in with a question, but can I, Tricia?
I was just gonna say, you know, you said before we got started that Lois has interviewed you, and now you kind of can't wait to ask her questions and put her on the spot. So Doug, by all means, like, go for it with the first question.
All right, sounds good to me. So yeah, I'm really interested in, again, the connection between the body and the ineffable. And it comes up again and again in your work, to where like you search for meaning, a speaker finds meaning in the body, and then that leads them almost a portal towards kind of almost this epiphany, or almost a kind of a gesture towards the spiritual. So I was wondering if you could talk about that. Do you find the sacred everywhere? Or is it forceful? Do you have to look for it? Do you look at objects long enough until they almost become sacred? What's the process, my friend?
What a beautiful, beautiful question. And what a deep and resonating question, because I feel like that's where I live, you know? And no matter what I do in poetry, I mean, I can write some about some obscure theme or today's news or whatever, but my heart is really in that universe where the living and the, you know, not the living, but the physical and the metaphysical come together. And I'm always aware of it. And I think that that has a lot to do with where I started in poetry and the type of poets I have been drawn to and continue to be drawn to. So it's definitely a theme. It presents itself all the time. You know how different poets kind of tend to have their particular subject that they focus on. I don't know. And I decided I really love that. That is a part of who I want to be, and how important that feels to me in this world, because of, you know, how we're living and the conditions, the things we're subject to, you know. So I want to be always cognizant of those two worlds inside and in my work.
One more, just with process, that does the concrete image come first, or does the abstraction come first? Because I'm always interested in that, especially with students. I oftentimes have students, when they have like tons of abstractions in their work, like put like something concrete next to it, just as exercises over and over again. So I was wondering for you, like, or do you just kind of find it through the music of the poetry, or is it kind of those exercise kind of driven generative moves?
I think it just comes naturally, you know, like when it happens, right? So we want those sort of magic connections to happen, but they don't always do. But when they do, they're complete. They come together, if that makes sense.
It sounds a little bit intuitive. And, you know, for those who have just heard Lois's two poems and not read the book yet, first of all, definitely go get the book. But I'll say, Lois, the book is so lyrical. You know, the whole book has that level of lyricism that the two poems you just read have, and these really wonderful images. I think Doug put the nail on the head. You know, there's this metaphysical spiritual world, but then pairing it with you know, an image. And I'm really struck by the uniqueness of the images and wanted to ask where some of those come from. Particularly listening to the poem you just read, I remember encountering it for the first time in the book, and that image of, oh, it's like a bolt of silk against a sand dune. And I just thought, I've never seen a bolt of silk against a sand dune. Is this an art piece that I've never heard of? Where did that image come from?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, it's I think we're constantly trying to draw as poets on similes. We're looking for those rapid fire leaping images that connect to one thing to another. And I think that sometimes we can get lazy and we don't use that very much. So for me, a lot of it comes from not my words, but the undercurrent of that kind of leaping comes from poets who do that kind of leaping. So I will then read somebody who, you know, completely gets that energy happening in me. And then suddenly I'm like, oh, I got to run to the computer. And, you know, here comes a line, you know. So as in the first poem that I read, just to mention that, Foal, which is, you know, rather a dark poem. But I had read the entire book, Fugue for Other Hands by Joseph Fasano. And that was a transformational book for me because his use of metaphor was so rich and so unusual and musical. And I had been going, I hope you don't mind me getting into this part of it too long, but.
No, absolutely.
Okay. So I had been dealing with my brother. He passed away last year, but he'd had a lifetime of issues of being mental health issues and didn't live on his own and stuff like that. And so I was kind of taking care of him a lot. And I was very frustrated at a certain point with the abuse my father had given to him and to my sister, not given, but, you know, the abuse that had occurred when they were children. And I read those poems in Fasano's book, and that was the metaphor. It was the horse. It was like that first line came, and I said, holy shit, because it could hold the tension, you know, it could hold that really painful tension of despair and injustice that I felt for my family. And yet I could control it in that poem, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. I think we've even talked about this on the podcast before, is, you know, life is full of so many big emotions. And sometimes just when you can put a word to it or a metaphor to it, there's something about that is so deeply cathartic. I like the idea that it's, I can control it, as you said, you know, it gives you that moment of feeling like in a world where not much is in our control. Well, how I describe this, how I explain it, I get to control that, if nothing else. And that on its own can be very empowering.
Very empowering. I think exactly that. And it felt like a freedom because we all have these times in our life or incidents. Some of them are just waiting for the right thing to springboard it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it holds and holds in you. And then suddenly you find the thing and you know, that's it. That's going to do it, you know? And so that was very talking about the easy poem, easy, not in the sense of the subject, but easy in that it came like a flood, you know?
No, and finding this power through naming, and dare I say, finding revelation through naming and through describing, is something that is really, really moving, and that happens in this text again and again. And I see all these different portals to that realm. And I think one of them end up being, besides the body, besides Ephraces, another one ends up being the seasons. And like, so within these last two poems, this winter, this every image in both of these, I think these poems could be, you know, examples purely in a class of showing, like having a good image inventory of all your images talking to each other. So all these come back to winter or the color blue or white, making that kind of overtone. So I wonder if you could talk about craft and finding that, and where do you find that lyric unity within the piece? Because, you know, so often, you know, especially when you're reaching through the imagination, trying to find the kind of evocative language that you have, it's hard to keep it all in the same family. So how do you find that, my friend?
It's interesting. I did get very excited about the way, again, Fasano dealt with the seasons. He had a thing for October, and what happens in that big transition. And I've always been drawn to winter. I feel like winter has some kind of so many layered aspects of what can be expressed spiritually, because there's an area which is solid but also nebulous. There is a luminosity. There's a death in winter, but also a peace in winter. So I find that seasons have a lot of layers of, you know, I'm like, you won't find me writing a lot about summer, even though I love summer, you know, because summer is kind of just like, it's so cool and everything's happening. And, you know, there's not a lot of mystery in summer, but there's mystery in winter. And there is in fall, and that change and what happens. And when we feel that cool air and the leaves start rattling, you know, it's like, ooh, I love it. You know, what's hiding in there? And I don't know. So I find those two seasons very evocative. Spring is great too. Spring, you know, we love spring because a lot of poets do spring, right? And it evokes a sense of beginning and all of that. But I would say definitely finding a season perhaps that you really gravitate toward, that allows you to express some aspect of you or something that you've been focused on a long time and haven't been able to bring out.
You talk about this, and I have to ask, where are you from originally? Are you from California?
I'm from Chicago.
Okay, because you talk about fall and the changing of the season. I'm California born, lived almost always in California, and I'm going, what is she talking about? There's a big change in October? You mean that 5-degree temperature drop? No, of course, in the Midwest and places that aren't California, you're right. I've seen pictures. The landscape changes dramatically.
Like, I'm one of those weird people that dream of, you know, living in Iceland or Norway or something like that. I love those.
I mean, it makes you think of Stevens, right? One must have a mind of winter, you know, that's like, right. And I come back to that again and again. And I think, right. You know, there's something about being the kind of terminality and liminality, like you said. And I think it kind of gets almost to the deaf impulse that so many, and that kind of lean towards deaf to so many poets, including myself, like find themselves when we're in that poetic space and then that poetic kind of meaning making. And I adore, I have to just say out loud, the idea of advice to young poets. I want to yell this so that everybody who listens to the podcast will listen, is finding a season to wrap around. Because I feel like so many of my images come back to fall. For me, it's always fall being an Indiana boy. So I think, you know, we all might have a season. Trisha, what's your season, homie?
Yeah. I know, I'm thinking about this and it's like, I think actually mine probably would be spring and summer, because—
You California, you know, girl.
California, and it's the fecundity, and it's like, look, I feel like life itself is already kind of full of enough fall and winter and everything. So when I get control, if I get to control the world on the page for a few minutes, why not fill it with butterflies and all the fruit that comes in the fruit stands at summertime? So that's probably my initial season. But of course I'm often drawn to the things that I'm not in poetry. So, you know, I'll really enjoy poems about winter and transformation and change. And I think, Lois, you used the word luminosity, and especially if you live in a snowy climate, winter, the whole landscape changes so that everything is covered in this kind of sheen and glitter, and it does make it seem very otherworldly. So I've seen pictures anyways.
Oh, sorry. especially in an urban environment. Everything changes.
So it dampens all the hard edges. That's exactly what I remember the most about living in a city that had real winter, you know, like in Indianapolis when we get it, like suddenly all the edges are like rounded. And suddenly, like, just like deaf, you know, it ends up being this great kind of equalizer, in that, like, you know, everything takes on the white in the same way, just like death is knocking on everybody's door. It's really beautiful.
Right. Beautifully said. Yeah. And how even, you know, general kind of bleak landscapes transform, not just in buildings, but you go into a park and the snow is covering the trees and it's covering the grasses, and that park that was kind of strange before is something new, right? It's another world. So I love the seasons for that reason.
So this is an appropriate time, I think, to ask about how you generate a poem. I have in my mind that from reading your poems that you just walk into a garden and the poem comes to you in an ethereal way. Maybe a butterfly brings it on their wings, but I have a feeling that that you probably have to do some work to create that feeling. So tell us a little bit about the process for you.
So if I'm lucky enough and say it takes me to an ecstatic type of poem, I might be in an environment where that is allowed to open and where I can resonate with the space. For example, I wrote a poem after a music installation at Descanso Gardens, where they had speakers set up in the trees of the oaks and at the foot of the trees. And there were these ancient music that was playing, like from Eleanor of Aquitaine, and words that were repeated in these soulful sounds. It's hard to describe, but that happened right around the time when George Floyd was murdered. And so there was this intense juxtaposition of tension and despair, and then this incredible infusion of beauty. So when I have those two kind of counterpoints playing against each other, that can create a poem, if that makes sense. That's a way, you know. I also love the poetry school, which is in the UK, and they have lots of great courses online, and I've taken quite a few, and I can do well when I'm very focused. Like if I have a specific subject, or let's say we're working on ekphrastic poetry and I have a project, so I'm going to write all my poems related to my project for that course. And that really keeps me on track with my book, my next book.
Yeah, and the book, Night Ladder, I see this theme coming through. It's a lot of it is response to art, but also history, you know, and it seems that the book takes on a few different, sometimes it's persona, sometimes it's, you know, focusing on a particular person or responding to a particular quote. I noticed Joseph Fasano was in there twice, which I really enjoyed because, you know, he's a friend of mine on Facebook, and I think that's how I know his work, but I keep seeing his poems popping up on Facebook, and every time I read one, I'm like, oh, I gotta get this book.
Get the book. Yeah. And he'd make a great guest too.
He's on my list. He's so like, good. Once I get back to the US and I can actually buy books again and get the books that I want to read, he's definitely on my list for tapping him to talk. So I wanted to ask a little bit about the genesis of the book too. Was it your intention to put all of these things together, or were they coming organically and then eventually you realized, hey, I've got a book here? Could you talk a little bit about the genesis of the book overall?
Yeah, I think first books are always somewhat semi-autobiographical. Mm-hmm. They just can't help but be that way because you got those poems that got to get out there and they're telling stories, even though some of these are based on, you know, not myself, but quite a few of them are. So that book was cooking for a long time, my first, and hopefully not my last. So it came over a period of years since I started writing, just tentatively, like around 2005. And then it took all that time till 2017 till I felt like the book was ready to be birthed. And I think even then, it's always difficult to let it go, your first book, you know. But I did, and I'm happy with it. And I'm happy to be also working on my next collection. So, you know, that's the thing. It's just, I took on the subjects that seemed to, I have many poems, let's put it this way. You know, when you have that kind of time, then you're gathering in work. I had to try and find a sort of synergy between the poems. And of course, the spiritual and kind of, and the mysterious again. Also, a lot of the poems are inspired by place. So there's poems, you know, a lot of travel poems are in there. And that is like a heat lamp for me. That really, as soon as I'm on the road or get a chance to go flying somewhere, it's like all my, you know, tentacles come out and I'm ready to start writing. And I may not write there, but, you know, that portal is opened. It's wide open. Yeah.
The book felt like it was very centered in Europe, you know, because you've got Rilke and you've got some poems that make references to World War II, I believe, and Germany. And, you know, so, yeah, I felt like the book was kind of spiritually centered in, you know, the Western European landscape and sort of a lot of the art, but, you know, some of the history in that area as well.
I think we're all touched by war so deeply. And, you know, some poets are able to write an entire book on war, whether they were a soldier or a victim or whatever. But I think those poems almost can't help but get in a book these days, you know.
We'll get back to that interview in a moment. If you enjoy this podcast and want to learn more about us, log on to thepoetrysalon.com.
Most writers need a community around them to sustain their motivation and excitement for writing. The mission of the Poetry Salon is to provide inspiration, education, and support for poets everywhere at a price that is affordable.
Together, we are building a thriving community through online classes, e-courses, and readings, so you have the tools to live the life of a growing, prolific, accountable writer.
You also get opportunities to share your work and receive supportive feedback, then turn your finished pieces into journal submissions, building an audience for your writing.
Again, visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today. I want to return to Phrases a little bit, because there's so many different approaches one can take, and in this text you take many approaches, from the kind of a reportage of imagery to the narrativization of the imagery to the kind of leap to a portal to a new world. So I was wondering, when you create poetry and when you're kind of taking notes on a painting or a piece of art when you see it, how do you find the right approach? How do you find an approach that fits? Because again, you don't only do reportage, you don't only narratize, you do all of it. So I was wondering how you figured that out, Lois. It's always difficult for me. I don't do a phrases very often, to be quite frank. I always feel like that I have too much of a one-to-one ratio with what's on the painting for this writer. So I'm always impressed when people can make it go somewhere else. How you do that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's, not to sound woo-woo, but it's very meditative.
We're all woo-woo. Don't worry about it. We're all woo-woo here.
You can't be woo-woo on a poetry podcast. Where can you do it?
I mean, look at Trisha's background.
Elephants marching behind my head.
Right. Yeah, so I think I approach it from, you know, again, in the example of the second poem that I read in La Scapigliata. So I was so intrigued by the sketch of this woman with disheveled hair. And I didn't know why. I just knew something was there. And I'm sure, Doug, you've come across a piece of art that called to you and you couldn't say what it was, but there was something you needed to say about it or feel or express. So those four parts feel they're together, but they're somewhat disparate because they're leaping off points. Each one's, I go in one direction and kind of finish that. And then the second one, I have another run at it. And this is how I feel about it and so on. So I keep kind of running at it to see what it is that the painting or the work is trying to tell me. And then ultimately what that poem wants to be. And in this case, it really did co-join with a dream that I had about waking up in this 13-year-old girl's body. And I looked in the mirror and I knew that it was not me. Like, I knew the spirit was me, but the body was totally different. And I looked in the mirror and I said, oh my God, look, it's you, but you're in a new life. You're in a new body. Look at this new body. Wow, this is great. You know, I know that sounds very strange, but that was the dream. And so somehow this made a connection to the sketch and this idea of the unfinished sketch, you know, the type of gloss, the type of clear glaze that allows for many layers to be in one person. And I don't know, I guess ultimately that's kind of, I feel like I could continue to write about that painting, you know? Yeah.
I love the way you put that. And it's taken me years to understand this quality about the writing and about art, but it's supposed to be unfinished. It's an, you know, writers and writing teachers will always say, like, you know, the text confronts you. And I didn't really understand what that meant, but I think it means like you're supposed to be forced to try to do your own brain work to complete the text. My husband is a graphic novel guy. Like, he really loves graphic novels and not just reading them, but also reading, you know, theory about graphic novels. And he made it really a little clearer for me because he showed a panel of a guy wearing a hat. And then in the next panel, the guy has removed his hat. And he says, between those two images, you imagine the man lifting his hand, taking the hat by the brim and lifting it off. And I think that's so true of poetry and of art. It's not giving you the full picture. It's demanding that you do a little bit of work to complete the full picture, to interpret, well, why does this character do it this way? And so, you know, as writing teachers or editors, we're always telling each other, telling our students, you know, like, don't spell it out so much. You know, let the reader figure out some things on their own. And this person is a little bit of a control freak. That took me a little while to get that and say, like, don't explain it to them. Let them have their own interpretation. Let them finish, you know, and maybe they will finish it a way that's different from the way you planned it, but that's okay. That's part of the gift you're giving them, is waking up their imagination to something else. And it sounds like that piece, looking at Da Vinci, I mean, it woke your imagination up, which is what it was supposed to do.
And something to what you said too, leaving to the imagination, there's a conversation with art. So every art is a conversation, right? You're in conversation with the poem, or you're in conversation with the sculpture or the painting. You don't want to be told too much. Although some people like to have everything spilled out, and that's okay too. That's a different type of art, you know? But I tend to be more resonant with the abstract, not abstract art. I would probably call it, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm blanking here a minute.
Transportive?
No. So the R can be descriptive, in other words, but there's another word I'm looking for. It can be obvious, but it also can have suggestions. So then it's more
insinuate.
More of an abstract painting. Like there's a painter I love called Zhao Wuqi, for example. He died a few years ago from China and lived in Paris many years. And he would do these abstract paintings, but within those paintings, there was nature. There would be like these suggestions of mountains. You'd have to really look at it, or some other facsimile of reality in there, you know. And it just was stunning, because the more you looked, the more you saw. And I love that kind of conversation. That's what I want art to give me. That's what I want poetry to give me, is that ongoing conversation. And I want to be able to go back and, you know, take more from it.
That's lovely. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like this art kind of forces you to look longer. And the more you do, the more you're going to see. So it incentivizes you to take some time with it. Let's get into a little bit of the practicality, I guess, maybe the storytelling. So I'm guessing it was the second poem you read about the unfinished painting that was the one that came easily. Am I correct in assessing that?
No.
Okay, well, then you're going to tell us.
Right. So the first poem was actually the one that came easily. Difficult subject, but easy poem, because I found the vehicle through Joseph Fasano's book and the metaphor of the horses. So that poem came in a flood. And this latter poem, La Scapigliata, was much more of an effort. Because as I said, I kept running at it. I kept going, what do I want to say about it? And so that took me many, many attempts. And even after it became a film poem, then I could say, wow, look at the life it took on. You know, it became more dimensional. Obviously through film and through sound and the imagery that the filmmaker was able to pull in with the literal films of white foxes and snow, you know, it's like a poet's dream, oh my God, to see these really elliptical images come to life on the screen. And she was amazing at that. So I think that sometimes when a poem takes another form, you're able to see it again in a new way. And even that can give you ideas on how to expand it into something else. It's a source of just an evolution, I guess, an evolution of where the poem starts and then where it continues or what it continues to evolve to. Mm. I have a good friend who's having her poems. She has a film, not a film composer, but a classical music composer who's now taking on a lot of her poetry and transcribing that and writing to it for performed works. And that's another incredible manifestation of where words can go and how they can merge. I love the idea of merging, obviously, you know, with other art forms. I like hybrid type of things. So I hope I answered your question there.
No, it sounds like part of what allowed the first poem to be more, to come more easily is finding that metaphor and reading it in someone else's work first. And that's, you know, I think that's one of those pieces of advice that you get and it's always true. It's like, if you're having a hard time with a poem or about writing in general, just go read someone else's work for a while. And I'm always telling students at the Poetry Salon, you know, if you show up and you're just feeling dry or can't get it or whatever, like, you can show up to class and just sit in the corner and read while everyone else is writing. That counts. You get points. And then usually if you've done that enough, then hopefully it stirs something for you eventually.
Absolutely. I think I'm very drawn, you know, I don't use that much a metaphor. I don't usually start with a metaphor and run all the way through. Sometimes I do, but that's not usually the way I write. So to find one and to follow it through to the end and have it work, when that happens, it's beautiful. When people do that, it's super powerful. You know, we have a lot of classic poems where that happens. I tend to go for more surreal, imagistic. You know, I was steeped on Lorca and my early beginnings in poetry. So I love these wild, kind of strange ideas. Neruda's the white flower of death, you know. Mm. Like when you put these ideas together, you go, wow. There's, my friend used to call it a battery. You know, there's a charge that happens between these images, and then suddenly, phew, wow, you feel it. You know, you can, it's almost a physical feeling that you get from it.
Yeah.
I mean, you took the top of my head off. I think, you know, going there, you know, the shout out to Dickinson, I just want to say some of the ones that really hit me so the audience can feel this of your magic, my friend, and your power. Purling stream to fold shame into. My God, do I wish I wrote that. Who are you? Are you my friend? Let's go one more time. One note on the stave of the infinite. And again, God, just the marriage of the concrete. And I think the other thing that I'm intrigued by is, and I guess it's cool that you're attracted so much to ephrastic pieces, because again, the intertextuality that's always happening. And we were talking about this idea that, you know, of art always being a conversation. And I, you know, of course, I'm thinking of reader response theory and the text needing the reader to complete the meaning. And so what are your hopes for a reader? What are your expectations for your reader? Who's your ideal reader? You asked me that before.
Mm. I asked you that. Oh, that's a good question, Lois.
I told you Lois is smart.
I think I get very excited when I don't have to explain my poem. When, even though there may be some, you know, abstractions or suspension of belief you have to make in order to get through the poem. I love when somebody sits across from me and says, this poem is blah, 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 you know, like they just tear it down and break it down in exactly what I had meant it to be. And there could be like three other people at the table who, well, I thought this was about, you know, going to the market when you got your pears and you were bringing them home, you know, whatever. I don't know. But, and then you're like, oh, okay. But when that reader gets you and gets you right back at what you're doing, oh man, that feels so good, right? And that's what I-
readers who sees you, who sees you, you would say.
A reader who sees you. I think that's why I loved to interview so much. Is because when I did do it, and there were those moments when I would talk to the person about their lines or what that poem meant to me, and they would like, you know, go, holy shit, wow, you know, it's so satisfying. And I think that's very exciting. It's almost like a divining rod, you know, you're just going over that poem and you're feeling it.
You know what's so funny? You're talking about this clarity between reader and and poet, and yet so much of the writing is about the mystery. I just find that an interesting juxtaposition. And maybe that's what the tension of poetry is, hey, let's get really clear about this mystery together.
Somebody said, I don't know the source of it, but about good poetry being a mystery you can trust.
Ooh.
Oh, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A mystery you can trust. I love that. That was another one that has always taken me a while to grapple with that in poetry, that you're not necessarily there to bring this clarity to the reader. You're there to sit with each other in the questions, in the unknown. I mean, it's a very Rilke statement, I'm going to butcher it, but like, live the questions until hopefully you've lived long enough that you will live your way into the answers. Something like that. Yeah.
I think that's Letters from a Young Poet. Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lois knows the whole catalog, so I knew you would say that. I knew you would have it in you, Lois. And I think it also gets at that kind of Keatsian idea of negative capability, right? Being able to exist in those kind of uncertainties, and that being, I always tell students, that's why I think being a writer is a vehicle to being a better person, not a good person, but a better person as well, is being able to stand in that. So is it uncomfortable, the writing space for you, Lois? The writing space, the more and more I scribble, the more and more intense and uncomfortable, or is it a safe space for you? I feel like it's getting a little bit more uncomfortable for me. What about you? That kind of space in which you can create.
So I think for me, it goes in phases. It goes through moods. Right now, I'm in a good space for it because I'm really focused on my project, and I'm feeling good about the work that's coming from the project. And I'm also revising, and all of that is kind of moving in a good direction. So I know that I have another maybe chapbook out there where I'm going to have to write about my brother and everything that went down with that. And I'm not looking forward to it because I know it's going to be very uncomfortable and it's going to bring up a lot of unresolved feelings about all of that. But I do feel that the subject is big, and it's another big one for me. And so I want to tap into that at some point when my mind is ready for it,
I did want to ask that earlier. Do you feel that some of that living with someone who has a very different view of the world, I could talk a lot about mental illness and the connection between that and creativity, but do you feel that that's helped inform some of your interest in the mystery, or your way of, grappling with how the human mind works?
I have a strong spiritual background that is also somewhat scientific. Mm-hmm. So it is not through psychology or psychiatry. It's actually a different methodology in the way I look at the human mind and the spirit. Mm-hmm. So I think that it has informed my awareness of how challenged we are to deal with these issues in the world and the very small amount of answers we have to resolve these ongoing things. And that we have been given the solution of medications and other types of maybe non, let's say, green. I'm looking for green mental health, I'm looking for ways in which we can rehabilitate the whole spirit, mind, body, and allow people to get through their issues in a way that incorporates the whole self, including the past, without suppressing what has occurred through drugs. And I mean, I could go on this topic for a really long time, but I had quite an ordeal with my brother, and very challenging. So, and a horrific experience with the mental health I'll call industry out there. Yes. And social services and stuff. So I just feel it's important from my point of view to kind of bring forth another element or layer of how this could be looked at.
Well, I'm glad you're writing about it, and I will be very interested in reading the poems. It's an issue near and dear to my heart. You know, I've a background in psychology, and I have a number of friends and students and people who have multiple diagnoses, and I'm very curious about what are the better ways of healing. Certainly don't fault anyone who is taking medication, but I do think there's more to it than that. And it is a cultural issue that we need to address as well. So, right. You know, for me, poetry has always definitely been one of those ways. And that's something else that I think about too, is like, you know, I like writing poetry. It seems very silly and non-functional. And yet this has been really good for me on multiple levels. How is that? Why is that working? You know, why is it sometimes sitting and writing about a bad experience actually makes me feel better afterwards, you know?
It's an alchemy. It's an absolute alchemy, because you're transforming experience and pain into something else.
Yeah.
So you are causing that to happen through your words and through poetry. And that's a beauty. That's a marvelous thing, right?
Yeah, I think it's Galway Kinnell has a really wonderful line called, I'm going to forget the name of the poem it's in. He says, even singing a sad song requires an absolute happiness. I've just always thought, you know, that's true. Even if you're singing a sad song, well, you know, the power of singing and your whole body works together and you become this instrument for sound, and it's something that's kind of ethereal.
That's why we love the blues, you know, we love them.
Yeah.
They dig in deep. So you get that happiness, right? But you get those blues too. You feel it all at once.
The tragic comic.
Yeah.
And I think that's where always, you know, and it goes back to your idea of liminality, where like in those kind of between spaces or those spaces of bothness, which is, you know, one of the reasons when we started out talking of why we dig your poetry so much is that it can be in both of those worlds.
Thank you.
You know, I realize there's one question we have not asked, and that's the really important one. You brought it up I was thinking about it when you brought up October and winter and transformation. What is your astrological sign, Lois?
That's a deep question.
We do it every time on this podcast.
I know.
This is pretty crucial. Like if you listen to them, that. This is like, I think this is kind of Trisha's thing. Like this is our thing. Like when you or did you and Kelly do it too?
No, used to be. I think it just came up organically a few times, and now it's like, well, it's tradition. You have to do it.
Yeah, we can't leave. Like we have to know. Oh,
good,
you know.
Good. I like it. Well, I was listening to your interview with Kelly recently. I'm really getting into that, and the whole thing about the titles and which was a very interesting topic. You know, deep actually. And I love I know I'm segueing for a minute, but I love the fact that she's like the title maven. So people threw their poems at her. She called them headless poems. And then I thought, I want somebody to be my title person, you know, like go. That's a whole new hat, right? Somebody could wear that hat, totally. But anyway, I hadn't gotten to the end, so I didn't get to the horoscope phase of the program. So I am a Cancer.
I knew you would be a water sign.
Just like my son. Oh my goodness. Oh, so yeah. You're going to have to give me all of the Cancer advice, you know, being a Leo and having a Pisces wife, I feel as though that I will have no more fire the rest of my life. They're going to pour water on my fire, huh?
Oh, no.
Doug, you've got enough fire. You've got enough fire. You're going to just boil those two. You're fine. You got so much fire. Like, you'd have to be surrounded by water to be dampened down at all.
What day is yours, Lois?
It's the 4th of July.
Oh, my goodness gracious. My goodness. What a blessing and a burden, though, huh?
Yeah.
Cookout every year.
Kind of weird these days. But
And summertime shy birthday. That's like kind of fun. Did you go to Lake Michigan every time?
What did we do? We used to go to a place called Soldier's Field.
Oh, of course you did. Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And awesome. That and they had, you know, that's where they had the football games and stuff.
Yeah, where the Bears play and saw the fireworks on the field. That's dope. Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah. Later. Now they have them on the lake, which is
yeah, that's where I thought you were gonna say. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no. Amazing. Never got to the lake, but yeah, so 4th of July, 10:05 p.m. So I just made it. I was in the pocket 2 hours.
Goodness.
Yeah.
What's the best advice to love my cancer son the best?
Oh, he will love you so much.
Give me some cancer love. What do you need? Do you need affirmation?
Yeah.
He'll just love you? Me?
He's going to love you. He's going to be a good listener. He's going to be gentle. He's going to teach you things. Okay. He's going to be this kind of person who is able to resolve things through his calmness, through his demeanor. I don't know. I feel like I'm looking at my crystal ball.
You're kind of setting this kid up. Like, you're setting a lot of expectations there.
But I can feel that energy from Lois. I can feel that energy from Lois and a lot of the cancers that I know. But then I also know that sometimes, again, sometimes they rub, like, again, like where there's just little rubs. So I was wondering.
They walk sideways. So they won't always tell you what's up, you know, because they do the crab thing, right? And they retreat also. They definitely retreat into their crab shell. And especially when you're a creative person, you really retreat into your shell. We all do that. We all got to do that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This kid is going to listen to this podcast one day and either hold it against you. He'll totally confirm it, or he'll just be all like, what are they talking? All I can say again is, Lois, it's really a pleasure to talk with you. And everyone, you guys need to get this book, Night Ladder, Glass Liar Press. It is a beautiful book. Don't read it quickly. I was in a hurry. I had to read it quickly. And now I have to go back and read it slowly in a garden with my own journal next to me so I can be inspired to steal some of that magic and ignite my own work.
Van Lummis used to say that it's like eating a box of chocolate. So you just have to like eat one at a time, enjoy it.
It really is. I mean, it would be a great book to have with you when you're traveling, or like maybe read one right before bed, or read one starting your day. Read it through the winter time, maybe. Although I could enjoy reading it in a garden full of flowers too. But yes, definitely take your time with this book. It is a book to be savored. Lois, thank you so much for being here with us. Such a pleasure.
You're so cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for your work. No, I hope the questions were good. I hope we were on your level. Like I said, you have a high level to reach, so I hope we're on your level.
You were right in the pocket. Thank you so much. I had such a good time with you guys.
Do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Please rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It helps us get heard, get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
Are you a poet who wants to be interviewed on the Poetry Salon cast? Contact Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com and send some of your work to be considered.
And don't forget that this writer will be teaching a guest workshop on the last Sunday of this month at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To purchase tickets, write to Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com.
Thanks again for being part of our community. And whoever writes the worst draft wins!
Yay!